Thank you, Dan.
My name is Dan. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 6, 1986. I came into these rooms after, after having a couple of spiritual experiences, but mainly I was in trouble and I asked God for help and I said, if you get me out of this jam, I'll never drink again. And at the time, I was in the United States Marine Corps as a Marine officer, really hungover, drunk, drank for 4 straight days, slept 12 or 3 straight days, wait, Friday, Saturday, Sunday into Monday, and maybe slept 12 or 15 hours. And I passed out on the side of the road on my way back to Quantico, Virginia. And I haven't had a drink. That was September 5th, 6th, 1983. And when I first got into this program, I was in the United States Marine Corps, and I was an officer. And one of the jobs I had was I was the drug and alcohol control officer. So I had to really, kind of live to the model of lead by example. So I couldn't do drugs. It was not a good look. So I was clean. But when I got out of the Marines, I got back on the block, and before I knew it, I was using dope because I wanted to, and I knew that if I was able to say a prayer before somebody passed me some dope, blowing weed, I would pass, but I didn't want to. I did not want to. And that whole concept is a big part of my program. And it's one that I learned, in an uncomfortable way when I went back to California and I told my sponsor, he was, well, Dan, you got new sobriety. Dan said, what? He was, yep, you, a drug is a drug is a drug. And you chose to do something that was not on life's terms to live, and that's my deal. As a kid, and hanging around a gang of guys and the border of West Seneca, South Buffalo, we all went to grammar school in South Buffalo on Abbott Road, St. Martin's, and we lived in both South Buffalo and West Seneca, and did as much drugging and drinking as we could, and soon as I was back in that block, I was back in the rut. And that was how quickly, that was another lesson I learned, how quickly we lose everything we think we have when we choose to live life not on life's terms. And so along the way, I think, well, something we read every day, I'm just, extremely grateful that I'm constitutionally capable of being honest with myself. And that's something that I'm just really, really grateful for. And I don't have to go through the trials and errors and throwing stones and being uncomfortable and having a knot in my stomach all the time and being pissed off. And when I was a kid, in my 18s, 19, we live by like a day wasted is not a wasted day. We just got as fucked up as we could all the time. And that was the relief I had to this, the uncomfortableness of living inside my skin. As a young person, I grew up doing a lot of sports. I always liked working. I had my own paper route. I got a job at 16. But and in my neighborhood, I started drinking late, which was like maybe 14. But it's not when we drink or what we drink, it's what happens when we drink. Like I should have known the warning signs were there. Like my freshman year in high school, I was in family court because we got in a fight. And a blackout, I probably was, did something I should have done, kicked a guy somewhere, ended up in the hospital. Was goofy. And I just, drank my way through high school as much as I could. And I didn't drink during the week though. I wasn't a daily drinker, but I was a, Friday, Saturday, and then in the springtime, like right about now, we'd be out at Chestnut Ridge just getting trashed during the day. I remember going to school, like counting the number of drinks I had, the number of beers I drank over the weekend. We used to drink beers, 12 pack a night, especially on a Sunday and a Saturday night, maybe a Friday night, a little bit less, because I usually was coming from work or a hockey game, so I didn't have night to catch up. But that was just how I rolled. And in college, I lived here locally, worked, went to school at Canisius College, and did everything I had to do to get through college and drink and use and try to support my habit with odd jobs at bars and dealing dope and just trying to, I don't know. I was managing my life, managing. And when I graduated, I had this grand idea. People were going on trips to Europe. I went across the United States. So I loaded up a backpack and drugged my way from Buffalo to California and did everything in between from Houston. I had friends all over the country. Everybody moved away in the late 70s because of the no work here. So finally, when I got back here, I was working a little bit, and I was trying to get a job with my degree, and kind of did, but not really. I started working part-time and really never came together. But I was engaged in something that I really loved. I loved exercise, and I rode at the West Side Rowing Club, and before I knew it, that really consumed me. But it was the drugs that I liked, because I didn't have to drink to get fucked up. So I'll do dope and have to row the next morning, and a lot of guys were drinking. I wasn't, so I was able to try to stay have a step ahead of the game with dope. But the bottom line is, my girlfriend was pregnant. I was escorted out of town when she didn't want to marry me, when I was pleading with her when she was, and I pulled a Geographic. I had to get out of here. So when it, went on page 31, and it says, we took on more physical exercise, went to health farms and sanitariums, drank only natural wines. I smoked natural herbs. But it was this, the health farm that I realized I did. And that was 13 weeks at Parris Island, South Carolina. And that was my drying out, cleaning out. And I knew I was an alcoholic when I read that page. And that was my, that was it. I mean, I knew that I went away to get away. And, I don't know. I was just trying to follow God's will. At the time I was praying a lot because my life was upside down. My mother and father were going through a divorce. I, didn't live at home a lot. I had various apartments. And this girlfriend thing and the kid and not being able to be close to them and growing up not having a real solid because of a lot of factors. I had a brother who's mentally handicapped, and my father had to work a lot and drink a lot. It was really, didn't envision my life ending up that way, but it ended up being one of the driving factors in my life, because I wanted better. And I wanted better. And along the way, my drinking, really times in the Marine Corps, got me to where I had to be when I was had I had I was in the military, and I was moved at that time. I was in Quantico, Virginia, when I was on my way back there. Then I moved to the Midwest to go to artillery school, which I've always kind of enjoyed. Bill was an artillery officer. He was, he talks about a grenadier and drinking beer. I went to my first AA meeting in Lawton, Oklahoma, after having a bright light experience that brought me to a light, that brought me to a phone booth, that brought me to an AA, the first number in the phone book under capital A, capital A, and went to my first meeting and Soon after that, well, that day, that Saturday, that Friday night was a speaker meeting. All I remember is just the only requirement for to be here is the desire to stop drinking. I said, "Yeah, I don't want to drink." And I went to my first men's discussion meeting on Saturday. And many have heard my story. I told them I didn't know if I was an alcoholic, and this, I think, old timer, older guy, anyways, older than me, probably my age. I'm 66 now. Said, "Here, kid, here's $10. Go buy yourself a fifth. Tell us what happens." Like, no way. I know what's going to happen. I'm not going to know what's going to happen. That's the thing. Fight drunk, sex drunk, multiple car crash drunk, a good drunk. I remember, had fun, drove home. But most of the time, it was just waking up the next morning, just hating myself, just gnawing pain. Like, shit, it happened again. It was always my story. So I started going to these meetings, and I started finding myself and others. And I started finding out what others did to get well. So they gave me the book at this at Saturday morning, and the next day on Sunday, I was reading, and that's when I stumbled on page 31. I was like, shit, they nailed me. Reading inspirational books, I was doing all that, taking on more physical. I'm an alcoholic. I walk like a duck, shit like a duck, talk like a duck. And there's no argument. I'm not arguing the fact that I'm an alcoholic. I cannot drink like other people. And, I stopped drinking, and I started going to meetings, and I started, working the steps as best I could. I had some great sponsors, some out west, some here in Buffalo who are deceased. I remember figuring out that I have to take all my problems to a meeting. And I did that in 1986 when I lost my job in an accounting firm. And I ran into two people those that night at the I'm trying to think, that was a Friday night. That no, that was a Friday or Monday, I can't remember. Maybe it was a Monday. University Men's. I ran into Mike Kane. And then he introduced me to Charlie McDonough. Now, Charlie's deceased. He was one of my early sponsors, mentors. But Mike, if you're out there, you introduced me to Charlie, and my career has now emanated from that meeting. And that's it. We got to take, I took that problem to the meeting. I didn't drink. I asked for help. And he came. And so, along the way, and looking at my drinking, and life as an alcoholic, I've totaled 13 cars. I've been arrested a couple times. Never a DWI though. I don't know how I slipped that net. Wow. But I'm just super grateful that I was able to get honest about where I was. I looked at the record. And it wasn't well. So I really jumped into the meeting and really tried to just be better, climb out of the pit that I was in of self-loathing and no financial life, and doing what I had to do and just following the direction of my higher power, whom I call God. In the meetings that we attend. So, I mean, what happened was that I just started doing the meetings and I started being dry. I was going to one or two meetings a week, but I found myself in a crisis at gosh, 25, well, 20, yeah, 23 years sober. And I started listening to tapes and I listened to a guy named Clint Hodges. And I was like, wow. He was talking about being 23 years old and have to start all over. And I did. And it was at that point in time, I went through a great, great revival with my recovery and making a what we call the second surrender. Obviously, the first one is we surrender, we cannot drink. The second surrender is we have to just totally cancel our thoughts, feelings, and beliefs, and turn them over, our life over to God, and see what happens. When I first came in AA in the 80s, in early 83, 84, they used to talk about I was going to these meetings out in Southern California in the high desert, and all these burned out hippies out there from the 60s. And they talked about it's better than the A ticket to Disneyland. And I used to go to Disneyland when I was a kid, and we had friends out there. And the A ticket was like the Matterhorn, the biggest ticket ride you could get on. So I just I always remembered that, and I just kind of just keeps, trying to surrender myself to what God's going to give to me next. And along the way, he gave me a obviously a wonderful career. I have four children. My wife and I have three. That boy who was born in 1983, when I didn't get married to his mother, is now in my life. He lives up the road from me in Colorado, where I have a second home. He has two beautiful children. They're a big part of our life, my grandchildren. And that was probably one of the greatest gifts that was given to me, because I realized that when I looked at the record, I really was not doing well. And that woman who gave me that chance at life, like getting into this program and not getting what I wanted, really was the biggest part of a big part of my recovery. I got this program. I wanted something different, but I got into this program and developed a life that's been filled with a lot of education. I've got two master's degrees in my recovery. I'm a certified professional in the work that I do. And I now have three grown children. And along the way, I've taken everything to God in this program. I've not deviated from that first standard. And I was doing a little looking at my history before I came in. There's probably at least a half a dozen miraculous things that happened to me that like it didn't look like they were going to happen. Like I was in a huge jam, and then all of a sudden, he comes. And that practice is with me now, because I learned it when I was sitting at a table and they were passing dope around, and I said, yeah. And I knew all I had to do was say a prayer and it would have left. I think one of my favorite, when every bone in my body said, fucking drink and use, rip some dope, get high, and drink. And I said, oh God, what am I going to do? And I had just taken my son home. We went to Crystal Beach, and I took $10 out of my account. Now, this is 1988. And it was already spoken for. I wrote a check against it that day to pay a bill. And but I needed to take my son to Crystal Beach, and we bought tickets, and I only had enough money to put him on the rides and watch. I didn't have enough money to go on the ride with him. I think we maybe went on a Comet together, but that was about it. Big roller coaster. But I remember at the end of the day, as was in my life, we'd get an ice cream or a sucker on the way out, but I bought him an ice cream. Oh man, that looks so good. I wanted one. I didn't have enough money to buy two. And I was just so fit to be tired. I took him home, pretended everything was all right. I went home, and I don't know, somehow I was downtown. My apartment was downtown, and I was like, ah, fuck, I'm gonna go down to Chippewa. I remember the cathedral across the street from my office on Franklin Street was open. I went inside there and I just wept. I just wept. And three amazing things happened to me with that experience. Now, this is very common in my life now. That was a, I mean, every bone said, drink. And I prayed instead of drinking. The anger and desire and the craving left. I went home and slept well. Was driving to my first appointment, which was a breakfast meeting with a an old timer in my business, and he says like to check in on me, see how I was doing, and we had breakfast, and it was great because I was getting a free meal, which was really awesome. And we're talking, how's it going? Well, I was just really having a hard time. It was really working. He goes, well, you know, I know you're having a hard time. You just got to keep at it, kid. But he goes, I do want to give you a check. I did some business after you and so and so. Actually, Charlie McDonough were talking to a client of mine, and you didn't know it was my client. You grew up with the family. So they ended up doing business with me. And here's what I think you deserve. And he, I think he gave me a check for $250, which is like, wow, I can make my car payment now. I was like, holy shit, thank you, God. And I went right to that meeting, and then I walked, drove over to my office, parked my car, and went into my office. And back in the day, there used to be these little spindles with messages, and there was a message in there. And a guy said, hey, Dan, come to my office when you get in and see me. I want to talk to you. So I got the message, went to my a guy older than, you know, a friend of mine who was much older than me in the business and the life insurance business and financial work. And he said, Dan, I don't know what happened to you yesterday. But I had a dream you were starving and you were so hungry. You were licking the cracks in the sidewalk for crumbs to eat. He goes, so I don't know. Something just told me to buy this gift card. So here's a gift card for $50. I'm not going to give you money. Here's a gift card for $50. Buy yourself some food and eat. I was like, this is awesome. Thank you. I need food. I didn't have nothing. And there's a funny story. It was to Super Duper. And some people on this don't even know in Buffalo who don't where Super Duper is, but it was a chain of grocery stores. But those three experiences, not drinking, being able to sleep, having someone buy me a meal, give me a check. And then that, I was like, can't make this shit up. And I applied that principle so many times, so many times. You know, my son, who was now maybe 15 years old, just turned 16, which is like 26 years ago this week. His birthday was Thursday. He just turned 16. It was like June, this time of the year. And I've been watching this kid. I knew it wasn't right. I had been praying for years for him to be resolved in my life. He was living at his mother's house. I didn't get to see him much. We never had any real strict, you know, visitation rights. Everything was kind of like, just wasn't laid out. There was no agreement. I saw him as much as I could, but then he was busy on the weekends. He was a teenager. He was doing this. He was doing that. And I was when I did see him, I says, "This is not good." You know, he's just he's not doing sports. I'm seeing who he's hanging around with. You smelled nicotine on him at the time. That was bad. But I just knew something wasn't right. And I just kept praying for him to be resolved in my life. And I picked him up one day. Was going to take him and my two younger sons, Brendan and Dan, to the Bisons game. And I had food. I brought some food home. We had pizza and we were going to go to the game. I just rushed in, was going to rush out, quick meal. He says, Dad, I got to talk to you. I said, what's up, kid? He goes, no, really, we got to talk. He says, can I talk to you? I was like, okay, can we go outside? I was like, all right. He says, Dad, I got arrested for smoking dope. You know, he goes, no, I got arrested. I said, let me guess, for smoking dope. He goes, yep. I was like, Wow. Okay. I was just so pissed off. It's like, shit. I know what to do. And I remember, so I was just silent. It was one of those moments when you just didn't know what to do. I was sat across the dinner table from him. We ate some food. We left, went to the game. I was with my two little boys. They didn't know what was going on. And I just didn't know what to do. I got up the next morning, went to the men's group, the Abbey Road men's discussion group. I told the story. No, nobody even flinched. Nobody said, geez, Dan, that's terrible, whatever. It's just like, okay. And I remember when I went home and him and I had a heart-to-heart talk, and it was a lot of yelling, a little physical pushing around. And finally I said, I don't trust you. I don't believe what word you're saying to me. And this is bullshit. I said, here, I want to, here's a piece of a yellow pad of paper. Here's some food that wasn't eaten from last night. There's two pieces of pizza. Take this, go down to my office, write everything you've done illicitly, whether it's drinking, smoking marijuana, whatever. List who you're with, why you did it. And I wrote this weird column. Did they have parents that were married? And I said, when you do that, I'm going to cross-examine you. And if I find one lie, the only way you're going to get honest with me is if you tell the truth. And I cross-examine, I don't find any breach in your discussion. We'll start on some footing. But if I find a lie, I'm going to every parent on this list. And I'm going to tell them your kids are smoking dope and there's a problem out here in Alden. He goes, Dad, you can't do that to me. I was like, I can. He goes, a dope man's going to kill me. I was like, listen, if the dope man's doesn't give a fuck about you, why should I give a fuck about him? And that was it. He came home, we went through the whole drill, and I made a copy of it. I gave the original to his mother when I dropped him off that Sunday afternoon. And 2 days later, I got a call from his mother and said, we need to talk about Neil. Her and her husband at the time met me in for coffee, and it was decided he would li live with me. I was like, holy cow. It took an incident like this for him to move in. That's all I ever wanted was him to live with me and be able to be a part of his life, give him some love and direction. And he moved in. I was like, thank you, God. Prayer answers. I prayed 3 years for that when he was 13 to 16. God works in strange ways. These events that are awful. How do we know? How do we know? One of the another great tape man that I listened to, Bob Darrell. He always tells a story about the Chinese guy who's living in under the confines of the Chinese government. They come into town and they were going to take all the men. But prior to that, him and his son were living on the land, and they had a horse, and the horse went away. And everybody says, "Oh, this is terrible. Your horse is gone. What are you going to do for a living?" He goes, "I don't know. How do you know it's bad?" And all of a sudden, the horse comes back, and it comes back with a herd of stallions. And he puts him in the pen, and it's like, wow, this is great. Thank you. His son wants to break one of the horses, gets thrown, breaks his leg, is paralyzed. And he says, oh, this is terrible. Your only son is paralyzed. He goes, it's terrible. He goes, how do you know? How do you know? Next thing, the Chinese army comes into town, takes every woman and child to be used as a form of defense in a war they're in. But they left his son. And they didn't leave him because he was useless to them. And the father said, how do you know? So that's the moral of the story. We don't know the end at the beginning. We just got to run with it and trust, which is probably the biggest part of my spiritual growth is I've learned to trust. I have talked about the second surrender, but I was just really willing. I would go to Kegel wake-up call, just willing. I couldn't do it because I couldn't believe anyone could love a wretch like me. You know, I stole and did as much as I wanted to get what I wanted. You know, I remember one weekend of, I'm looking back and it's probably a Good Friday. It was a weekend, like Thursday, Friday. I mean, we had to drink. I didn't have enough money, so we stole a lady's purse. I mean, what the hell? I was a courier paper boy, and I'd go to the honor box, put 15 cents in, take 10 papers out, sell them, keep the money so I could drink again or buy cigarettes or whatever. And I couldn't, and I'm just brutal, brutal self-will run riot. I couldn't believe that a God could love me. I was willing, but I couldn't really believe and trust. And it was in about my, well, it was 2020, February, and I was to do the math, maybe 34 years sober. I was praying and I was doing the spiritual exercises of the Jesuits, and an exercise just meditate and bring your troubles to God and trust it. And all of a sudden he came over me. I heard like clear as day. How could you be so arrogant to believe you know more about yourself than me? I just wept. You know, a power greater than me gave me all trust. You know, I pursued it for 34 years. And because I knew it was the right thing to do. I was honest. I talked about that. And great things have come to pass. Great things. You know, just, gosh, great things have come to pass. There's nothing in my life that's been permanently damaging. Because how do we know when they happen if that's the worst thing? You know, I've had struggles in business with partners leaving, resigning. I've had employees who want to take me to the civil rights being violated because I hired an alcoholic and I tried to take him to meetings. Well, I did take him to meetings. He loved them. His work, his skills were woefully inept. We had to let him go, and he took me to court. I was really pissed off about that, resentful. So I started praying for him. 2 days before we were supposed to go to court, my attorney, we were supposed to have a pre-conference meeting. We have a Zoom call with him, me, the ALJ, administrative law judge, and I was just pissed off. He goes, "Dan, I don't know what happened, but we were supposed to meet today, but we really have nothing to meet about." I go, "What's that?" He goes, "Well, I was trying to, I know you tried to call and get the coordinates for the Zoom with the state tomorrow. And we were going to have this meeting today, but on Tuesday, the state called me up and said the claimant withdrew his claim. There's no hearing tomorrow. The case is closed." It's like, wow, it happened. He came again. I mean, that's just, I mean, I could, it's just, you can't even imagine the stuff that's come to pass in my life. So that's really the moral of my story. I've learned to be willing to believe. I'm capable of trusting now. I work at it every day. I roll out of bed and I roll onto my knees and I say the third step prayer. I ask God to help me be of maximum service to him and others and other alcoholics who still suffer. I try to be active. I've had a pretty rigorous travel schedule this year, and I knew it was coming. I had to withdraw some of my actions in the district and the area. But I started working with others and going through the book with two or three people at a time here recently, and what Bob Darrell, I heard him say on a tape one time, because he worked with alcoholics who go out after long periods of sobriety. And he's working with them, and he says, you know, I asked him if they go to meetings. He goes, yep, I've been going to meetings. You know, and I said, do you have a, is, were you working with, yeah, I still talk to my sponsor. He goes, yeah. And finally he says, we are doing service. We are doing service work. And they said, no. And he said, that's what I found. The common denominator with people with long-term sobriety, that when they drink, they probably weren't active any service. And that's what we do. We gotta, you know, how do we pay for this thing? You know, a couple bucks? No. With time and effort with others. Trying to spread the word. And so as our troubles, you know, are light and momentarily compared with the eternal glory being achieved by them, that's the thing. We're getting more right with our Maker. His will is really simple for the most part. Service to others. That's it. Maximum service to others. And so what it's like now for me is that I live, I'm a jaywalker, by the way. No, I've broken both my legs skiing. I love to ski. I've rehabbed back from both of them over time. I'm probably 4 to 5 years from working, instead of working full time, I only work, you know, maybe I work part time, I own my own business. I think, but the greatest thing for me now is as a kid, as a young person, I was just infatuated with control. And that I'll be happy when I get this. And I'll be content when I finish this. And when I do that, it'll be better for this. And that's not it. We just have to be content. Period. And I don't know how to do that on my own. What I'm living according to God's will and having a relationship with Him, I have. What is unseen, which is peace. I don't hate myself anywhere, which is a huge gift. I have some self-love, which allows me to love others. And you know, it's a world that's way better than anything I could have constructed on my own, obviously. Talks about it on page 100 when a new person works with their sponsor, looking back that they've achieved more than they could have ever imagined. And yeah, I don't know if you call, I mean, I try to be a spiritual person. You know, I'm pretty high into right on that stuff. But like, there's another page in the big book. It says, you know, you come to an intersection, the alcoholic either die or make a left-hand turn, die an alcoholic death, or make a right and live a spiritual life. And that's where I want to be. But for the alcoholic, that's a tough decision. They want to prove that they can drink and slip the net. I just know this. If you race them, they'll beat you. And I'll put my money on the alcohol beating you. I'm just not, I'm gonna, I just know that. I've seen it too many times, so many times. You know, so, you know, what I'm looking for now is what is unseen, which is just peace and following God's will. And there's a great story in the book. He sold himself short, and that's really what I believe, you know. If we get everything we wanted, we'd be selling ourselves short. So in closing here, you know, from page 267, he sold himself short. Above all, he says, I gained the greatest thing according to any man, the love and understanding of a gracious God who has lifted me from the alcoholic scrap heap to a position of trust where I have been able to reap the rich reward that come from showing a little love for others, from serving them as I can. And that's what this whole thing is about, giving more to others. So, you know, we opened up with the Serenity Prayer. The Serenity Prayer has two parts to it. We'll close with the second part, which is living life one day at a time, enjoying every moment at a time, except as hardship, accepting hardship as a pathway to peace, taking as he did the sinful will that he has, that if we surrender to his will, he will make all things right, and that we'll be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him in the next forever. I'm an alcoholic. I want more of everything. I want supreme, man. And that's what I'm trying to live. I'm out.